And we are at the top of the hour now, so I would like to take this opportunity to introduce our speaker. Today we are lucky enough to have Dr. Keith Humphreys presenting for us. He is a VA HSR&D Senior Career Research Scientist and Stanford Professor of Psychiatry in Palo Alto, California. So, Dr. Humphreys, are you ready to share your screen at this time?
I am.
Excellent. You should have that pop up now.
Okay.
Looks good.
Okay. All right. So thank you very much for setting this up, and thank you to CIDR as a whole for hosting this series. What I'm going to talk about today is how the exclusion of vulnerable populations, in this case women and African Americans, undermines the value of treatment research. And I'm going to be talking about psychiatric treatment research, specifically alcohol treatment research, but this is a more general issue, as I'll explain, that applies across pretty much every condition that medical research studies. We're always interested, those of us who do health services research are interested, of course, in translation and whether or not the things we do in research would actually work out in real-life practice, and that's part of what this research program is about. But it's also about social justice. So it's not just a question of whether science can inform clinical care, but whether it informs it adequately for everyone in the system in an equitable way, irrespective of their gender, their race, their ethnicity, and so on. So it's those two questions that have driven my interest in this the last 10 years, the translatability per se, but then also the question of health equity. Okay, so we're going to start with a poll so I understand who you are. So let's go ahead and find out who you are.
Thank you. So for our attendees, you can see a poll question up on your screen at this time. Please select the circle right on your screen that best corresponds with your primary role in VA. We understand that a lot of you wear many hats within the VA system, but we'd like to get an idea of your primary role. So the answer options are student, trainee, or fellow, clinician, researcher, manager or policymaker, or other. And if you are selecting other, please note that at the end of the session, I will put up a feedback survey that has a more extensive list of job titles, and you may find your specific one there. So please stay tuned to fill out the feedback survey. Looks like we've got a nice responsive audience. We've already had almost 80% reply. So at this point, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll down and show those results. Dr. Humphreys, you're welcome to talk through it, or I can review it real quick.
Okay, so it looks like we've got researchers are the biggest group at 43%, but certainly it's a diverse group, a quarter other, and then about evenly divided between trainees, students, fellows, clinicians, and managers. Good, that's a nice range of people, and I will try to make it as relevant as I can to all of you, given your different roles.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and turn it back to you now.
Okay. Getting the hang of this. Okay, so let's start with evidence-based medicine. You all know about that, I'm sure, in regardless of which capacity you work. So the rough idea of this, as you all know, is that high-quality research, generally assumed to be well-controlled research, is going to identify what works in healthcare. And the reason we want to do that is because we know that everyday clinical practice in many areas, for example, the area I work, alcohol use disorder treatment, is often ineffective. It's not sufficient just to say we'll just do whatever we think is right or just do what we think is medical necessity, because we're often wrong about that. So the research is supposed to help us figure out what's right. So, and evidence-based medicine would say that when we do that, then we'll be able to translate it into practice, and that will improve the quality of healthcare and improve outcomes. Who could possibly be against that? Nonetheless, there's some people who question this argument. I'll give you a couple of good ones. So I've spent a fair amount of time in Britain, and I think the British, there's two kinds of writing they do better than anybody else. One is obituaries, and the other one is really snooty editorials in medical journals. So this is one of my favorite of that sort, which was written by Smith and Pell, and this is a sort of, they're pointing out that they did a meta-analysis of how many randomized trials do we have that parachutes provide protection from gravitational challenge. And what they say is there are no randomized trials, therefore you shouldn't be worried about jumping out of a plane without a parachute because there's no randomized evidence that that would be better. But of course that's silly. You know, we would never do that. We know lots of things without randomized trials. And they point out this sort of a weakness of evidence-based medicine in assuming everything must come down to us from that way. So, as if randomized trials were on the mountain bringing down the commandments to us. Another really great snooty British editorial is by D.P. Koenig called Lies, Damn Lies, and Evidence-Based Medicine. And it's a bit overstated, which is what makes it fun to read, but, you know, points out that, many things in clinical practice are just fundamentally different than research, what you're allowed to do, what you can do, what your responsibilities are, what your sensitivities are. And, this is, I think, undeniably true, even though he overstates it. And one of the issues in that has particularly interested me for a long time about that gap is that the people who we study are so different from the people we treat. And that is what I've been focusing on in this program of research. So the first thing I did on this was very, very crude. I literally did it in an hour. And there was a paper by Carolyn Swearingen, who actually at the time was in the VA, and she reviewed hundreds of alcohol treatment studies and just purported, who actually do we study? And those are the blue bars, which is probably an unfortunate color choice given the background, on five demographic variables. And I saw that paper and I thought, I wonder who we actually treat. So there's a system called TEDS, Treatment Episode Dataset, that is maintained by the federal government about who's in treatment. So I just did a little chart and just saw who do we study versus who do we treat for alcohol disorders in the United States. As you can see, they're really different people. If you're in research study, you're about half again as likely to have a job. You are less likely to be a woman. You are somewhat more likely to be white, have white race. You are way more likely to be married, more than twice as high, and you're much more likely to go to college. And, this is not fancy research. This is very crude. But, it was just sort of intriguing to me. These differences are large, and, they also are different demographically. And also, these are differences that you would think might change outcome, meaning that it could be that research is drawing conclusions about the effectiveness of treatment that don't actually apply when you look at the real world of who seeks care in the U.S. So what can we do about that difference between who we study and who we treat? Well, to me, what I decided to focus on one area is eligibility criteria, sometimes broken down into exclusion and inclusion criteria, but they're really just two sides of the same coin. Is that a place where we could lessen this problem where we have these very different samples we're trying to draw inferences from? So why would that be a good thing to focus on? Well, one of them is that exclusion criteria, by definition, impose rules that are unlike clinical practice. So if somebody walks in the door and they're 54, you treat them. You don't say, no, this protocol says anybody 54 and older isn't allowed to be in the study. So by definition, any exclusion criteria creates an unrepresentative sample. That is, in fact, the point of it. The researcher believes that they want a different sample for some reason, maybe to maximize power or to make the study easier to do. And when they do that, perhaps there's advantages to it. But at the same time, by definition, that makes the research sample different than patients. That is the point. The other reason I thought it would be useful to study this is that exclusion criteria are at least partially under researchers' control. Some exclusion criteria we don't have any choice about, like if something's going to be really dangerous. But other times we make a decision. I'll just stick with age as an example. Why does a study exclude people at 54 and older versus 60 and older, 65 and older? That's really our choice. And there's certain other things that have to do with why samples are unrepresentative, like the historical distrust of science in some communities, some populations. But we can't really change that as easily as we can change this. So I was appealed to me as something that we might actually be able to do something about, something we had control over. So I'll show you this, some of the studies that intrigued me early. Here's a review by Moncrief and Drummond in the field of alcohol treatment. And they looked at 25 really highly cited trials. So these were the ones that, were supposed to influence practice the most. First off, they found that half of these published trials didn't even tell you how many patients were excluded at all, which is kind of amazing and disappointing. But of the ones that did report it, the typical study screened out half of the patients with a range of 4 to 92%. And so you can imagine yourself, the study where 92% of the patients screened out. Unless you happen to be treating that 8% as a clinician, would you believe that study? And you might not, and you might not be irrational to be skeptical. So the questions that I've tried to ask in this research program, starting, as I said, with alcohol treatment, although we spread out from that since, is basically three things. First, just to figure out what are the exclusion criteria that alcohol treatment researchers actually use, and how often do they use them? The second one is, what difference does it make affecting the composition of samples? And that includes the sample's clinical functioning, but also these demographic social justice questions of, do these fall equally on males and females? Do they fall equally on people of color and European Americans? And then last, do the criteria change the results of the study? If you do enough exclusions, do you end up making your treatment actually look far better or far worse than it really is in frontline care? So I'm going to go through each one of these, one study of each one. So the first one is this question of, what criteria do treatment researchers use and how often do they use them? For my slides here, you can see my cursor. Rather than have bibliography in, I just put the references right here at the bottom when I introduce each study. So you can get them there. If you have any trouble finding them, just send me a note. I'm in Outlook and I'll be happy to send you a soft copy of it. And this was done with here at Palo Alto with my colleagues Ken Weingart, Doyen Hurst, Asha Joshi, and John Finney. So it started with data. I got interested in this question. I wonder, where would I find out what exclusion criteria researchers have used? And fortunately, John Finney had just finished a meta-analysis of all 683 English language alcohol treatment studies that had a follow-up and had at least 5 adult patients per condition. And this had been a very extensive project, included gray literature and all that. And John, being a very nice guy, I said, I'm interested in this, and he said, you can just have the data. Because he was looking at things like treatment outcome motivators and things like that, moderators. But he had his team copy down the exclusion criteria of these nearly 700 studies verbatim, and they were just sitting there as data. So that was where I got my data from John's kindness. And we had a couple of raters train on it to learn how to describe each study. We did the usual things you do of, checking their agreement regularly, testing them for drift as we went along. They generally did very well, as you can see by the reliability statistics there on the bottom in terms of rating different criteria. So we did this kind of iteratively. We started with what we thought were common criteria, then we read articles, and we saw we needed new categories and so on. But we eventually developed this system of coding different types of exclusions. And I'll just give you an example. There's no standardized way to do an exclusion criteria, so we would have categories. Like we had, for example, a psychiatric category. This would be where a researcher said, to be in my alcohol treatment study, you can't have psychiatric problems. But these are some of the things that would have fit in there. That might have been a study that said we excluded people who were psychotic. Sometimes they said we excluded people with co-occurring psychiatric problems. And yes, it really was that vague. A lot of times these are very vaguely stated. People posed a threat to themselves or others. Anybody taking psychiatric medication. Those are the kinds of things. In those cases, the coder would mark this study had a psychiatric exclusion. Here's another big category we had, which was compliance and motivation. So that might be a study that said unless people committed up front, they were going to attend every session of treatment, they weren't allowed to be in the study. Or if they were difficult or uncooperative. And again, those are quotes. Those are not our words. The people really do say things that vaguely that the researchers would just toss any patient out who they thought was difficult. Having to agree to a follow-up or judged by the researchers being motivated to change, whatever that means. So, again, for these, if the coder saw any of those things, they would code, that study had an exclusion for compliance and motivation. So we did that with the system, and this is what we found, looking over several decades. Here's how many exclusion criteria there were in these studies. So the UNK means unknown. So, unfortunately, over 170 of these studies, so that's what, a fourth, I guess, didn't even tell what their exclusion criteria were. So if you're an optimist, you would say they must not have had any, and so there was nothing to report. But if you're a realist, you would say they did exclude people, and they didn't say who or why, which means those studies are very hard to interpret. But that's unfortunate from a methodological viewpoint. From the rest, you can see the distribution. The modal study has 4 criteria. There are plenty that have, though, more than 7. So there are quite a few that are quite exclusive. What were the most prevalent criteria that we saw? Here's what they were. So about over 38% of studies about had some exclusion saying due to psychiatric or emotional problems. Slightly over 30% excluded people because of alcohol treatment criteria. That might be something like they'd been treated before, or they were going to seek treatment concurrent with our study, something like that. Medical comorbidities was common. I mentioned compliance and motivation. Neurocognitive problems tend to be mainly organic brain syndrome or extremely low IQ or a serious head injury. Illicit drug use, about a fifth said if you were using a drug, alcohol is a drug, of course, but if you had drug use or drug dependence on, you know, cocaine or heroin or whatever, you couldn't be in the study. And then about 20% of studies excluded people for social and residential stability, saying things like you had to have an address, a fixed address, and someone who could find you would follow up. We didn't take homeless people. We didn't take anyone who didn't have a job, and so on. There was some just fun to speculate about national differences when we looked around in how exclusive they were. The studies that are that let the most people in were done in the United Kingdom. The U.S. is more restrictive, and then the most restrictive, that's Germany, France, and Italy. You can see that. I don't know why this is. This is just a borderline significant finding, so one can speculate about it. I did mention this to Sir Richard Peto, who's a trial designer, and he was very happy to see that UK studies admitted a lot of people because he said, you know, the NHS, the National Health Service, is for everyone, so science should be for everyone. So he was happy that UK researchers tended to let everybody in. But anyway, I just put that up there just because it's kind of interesting to think about why that would be so. This is a simple regression model predicting how exclusive these trials were. And you can see, you know, which ones there were significant. So the decade of publication means as time is going on, studies are getting more exclusive. From like 70s, 80s, and 90s, more and more exclusions are being used in alcohol treatment research. And we looked if that was just due to better reporting, and it seems that it's not. The second finding is that if you had funding from the USNIAAA, which is the part of the National Institute of Health that funds a big chunk of alcohol research, you had more exclusive. That'd be like another 1.22. These are unstandardized B weights, so you have like an average of 1.22 more if you had that funding versus not. Private sector funding, which mainly was the pharmaceutical industry, were more exclusive, adding another almost one extra exclusion criteria. And then lastly, if you had a randomized design, you had about 1.4 more exclusion criteria. So that's what made things more exclusive in this literature. So that might mean, for example, you know, if you were looking at a pharmaceutical industry-funded randomized trial, it would tend to be pretty tight in not letting many people in if you put those things together, and even more so the case one done recently versus one done in the past. So what did we learn from this first study? Well, first off, that eligibility criteria, exclusion criteria, are very widely used in the alcohol treatment field, but they're poorly described. A quarter of studies don't even tell you what they are. Of the ones that did say what they are, they were often these sort of vague things, difficult patients not allowed, whatever that means. So things you can't really replicate or even really understand. Alcohol treatment research is getting more exclusive over time, or you could say less representative. So I tell people if they want to get an alcohol treatment study, you know, do it now before it's too late because it's getting harder to get in. And then last, these criteria don't occur randomly. They're more common with particular designs, like randomized designs, and they're more common with particular funders, like the National Institute of Health. That's study one. Now let's look at the second study. This is who is excluded. Are certain populations disproportionately excluded? Here's the paper on this, and it's co-authored with Ken Weingart and Alex Sachs-Harris. So we focused on women and people of color because we were thinking about, you know, the U.S. National Institute of Health has the policy where you have to report your representation. And this is not a controversial policy. Researchers agree with this. I mean, it's a good thing. I mean, researchers have come to this opinion, a shared set of values. And the question is, could you, when you start excluding people, could you inadvertently undermine this goal? And that's what we're looking at. So now we have to figure out how are we going to study this, because there wasn't any studies of this sort before, so we had to sort of make up a method. Here's how we did it. We knew from our first study what the most common exclusion criteria in the field were, and we operationalized them using an instrument called the Addiction Severity Index, which assesses addicted patients in 7 different domains: medical, psychiatric, family, social, legal, and so on. And once we had those criteria operated, then we took health services research data sets that were take-all comers. In other words, they were sort of real-world patients, pretty much, you know, with 100% enrollment or 99% enrollment or something. And then we would apply the operationalized criteria to those data sets, which would then let us see, had there been a study, who would have been in and who would have been out, and what happened to them. So study 2 is who's in and out, and study 3 will say what happened to those two groups. So that's how we went at this. So just to give you an example of how you would do this, you want to say, what is a psychiatric exclusion criteria? And, of course, these are implemented in all these different ways. So we had to have a sort of sensitivity-based way to do this. So we might have said, you know, using the Addiction Severity Index, let's say a low degree of exclusivity, so a rule that would not exclude many people, might say, well, we'll only exclude someone on psychiatric basis if they've had an inpatient psychiatric episode, if they've got hallucinations, suicidality, or they're on psychotropic medicine. A more moderate exclusive rule would say, well, if they have any two of those, we would say they have psychiatric problems are too severe to be in the study. And then a highly exclusive criteria would say, if they have any of these, we don't want them in the study. So we evaluated these in all those, you know, all those dimensions as we work with these real-world data sets. And here are some of the ones we used. We had great VA data. We had also some non-VA data from state systems. And again, these are virtually pretty much take-all comers. Who's coming into treatment in the United States? All of these data sets, the reason we wanted them is because they had all used the Addiction Severity Index, so we could operationalize the same criteria across all of them. So let me just give you one illustration how to do this. So this is one of the data sets. We had this from the state of Washington. They had 13 programs, all state publicly funded alcohol programs, all of which were in the study. They had a sample of 502 patients admitted treatment. They enrolled every single person. There's no eligibility criteria. The sample, 7% African American, about 38% female. Every single one, as I said, got an Addiction Severity Index. So here is the question for you. We're actually going to ask two questions back-to-back for you. So I'll turn it back over to you, Molly, for those two questions.
Thank you so much. So for our attendees, you now have that second poll question up on your screen. And the question is, which sort of exclusion criteria do you think would be most likely to disproportionately exclude African Americans? Psychiatric, medical, drug use, compliance, or social residential? Please keep in mind that these responses are anonymous, so feel free to answer as you would like. And people are giving this one a little bit more thought, so they're coming in a little bit more slowly, and that's perfectly fine. I'll leave it open until we've had a fair number of respondents. Looks like we're approaching just about 2/3 response right now, so we'll give people a few more seconds. Although I do see a strong trend, so we'll get a pretty good idea. So I'll go ahead and close it out now and share those results.
Okay, so what we see is in a study of alcohol treatment, the most common answer is that African Americans would be excluded if there was a social or residential criteria, like you got to have a job, you got to have a stable place to live. And then the next most common folks felt was medical comorbidities and being non-compliant, and very few people thought psychiatric or other drug use would make a difference. Looks like.
Thank you, and we'll move right along to the next poll question. So which sort of exclusion criteria do you think would be most likely to disproportionately exclude women? And we have the same answer options: psychiatric, medical, drug use, compliance, or again, social residential. Interesting that I'm seeing entirely different trends. So, all right, so we've had just about 50% of our audience vote, and we'll give people some more time. okay. We're just about two-thirds response rate. Still climbing. All right, we'll close it out at about 70% response rate and share those results.
Okay, yeah, different answers. So for women, what might exclude them from a study of alcohol treatment? The most common answer people thought were medical comorbidities, slightly over a third. And then there's the second most common answer, quite close, is a comorbid psychiatric problem or the social residential aspect. And then very few people thought, but not many, thought that a criteria for having to be compliant and not having illegal drug use would knock out women disproportionately. All right, that's great. So keep your own answers in your head, and we'll see what the answer was. Let me get this thing going. Are we back on?
We are.
All right, so here we go. When you're trying to figure out what difference an exclusion criteria makes, there's really two questions. One is, does it disproportionately impact some group, and how influential is it at all? So if you have, the reason I didn't put neurological on the quiz is that things like organic brain syndrome are so rare that hardly anyone is excluded by them. So that's up here. So if you have a more stringent measure, like you need a lot of neurological, only about 0.6% of people are affected. If you have a more loose thing, anybody with any indication of organic brain syndrome, it's still only 1%. So what that means is, even if these are grossly disproportionate, if women are far more likely to have organic brain syndrome or African Americans are, it wouldn't affect your composition because it's just so small. The ones that's going to matter are the ones we put on the quiz, which affect a lot more people. So this is if you have it tight, you got to have a lot of psychiatric problems to be excluded. This is if it's a kind of a looser thing. And as you see, if you got kind of a loose psychiatric thing, like some studies had any psychiatric problems, anybody on medication, actually most people with alcohol problems couldn't enroll in your study. Medical comorbidities, you see about, a third of people can't enroll. Drug use is hugely influential. So one of the real unfortunate things, the National Institute of Health weirdly has an institute just for one drug, which is alcohol abuse, and then they have National Institutes on drug abuse. So we have these separate research literatures, and lots of alcohol treatment studies say we don't want anyone who uses illegal drugs, and yet almost everyone in alcohol treatment does. So that's really, really takes out a lot of the sample. It's pretty rare, actually, if you work in treatment, including in the VA, to find a truly pure alcohol patient. Almost everyone uses some other drugs. Compliance knocks a small number of people out, and then social residential, you can see. Particularly if it's kind of loose, like if it's, you don't have a contact person to find you in 3 months, you don't have a job, more than half of people can't make that. So the average criteria of these most commonly used ones, if it's tight, it'll knock out about 1 in 5 people, and if it's looser, then it knocks out 40%. And remember, that's just one, because a lot of these studies are going to have multiple criteria, right? So you have to think, these are very conservative to look at any one, what proportion of patients won't be able to enroll. So here's the relative risk of being excluded for African American versus patients of other races. And I'm sorry to say my confidence intervals are not showing up. I'm sorry about that. Maybe I made them the wrong color. But anyway, we can still talk through this. So it's drug use is, if it's values greater than 1, meaning it's your disproportionate likely to be excluded. It is drug use and social residential. So if a study has a social residential criteria, it's going to disproportionately exclude African Americans. And if it's drug use other than alcohol, it's going to disproportionately exclude them. You can also see some effects the other way. Look at compliance. A study that knocks out non-compliant patients, as it turns out, those judged unmotivated, those who don't promise to finish treatment, African-American in alcohol treatment are more compliant than patients of other races. So actually, a study like that actually will increase your proportion of African-Americans, which is kind of interesting. A lot of these things are kind of unpredictable, and just give you, and that's the point. A lot of you gave the wrong answer. That's fine. One of my points is you really can't guess always the effects you're going to have. And just one simple example is, we looked at some study of, just saying that you had to live within 30 miles of treatment to be in the study, and the investigators just, they didn't have much resource for follow-up, so that's what they wanted to do. What they didn't take into account was that African Americans traveled much further to get to treatment. So by setting that thing, which they just thought was about distance and follow-up convenient, they pretty much ruled African Americans out of your study. So that's one of my messages in this research is, because it's unpredictable, you really have to be careful. You can really thwart your own goals. For women, It's interesting. They're all over one, except for compliance. So if you want to say who's going to, in a study that really has a lot of rules about you must be motivated, you can't be opposition, blah, 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 it looks like disproportionately those are white males you tend to exclude. Women are more likely to get in a study that has a compliance criteria. But for everything else, they're at some level elevated, with the highest being drug use and social residential, comorbid drug use and social residential. And I'm sorry, I don't have the comp intervals because some of those, like medical, is not going to be significantly different than one. But anyway, that surprised a lot of people. With all but one of the most common criteria are going to push women out disproportionately. And remember, lots of these studies have multiple criteria. Lots of them have a psychiatric criteria and a medical criteria and a drug use criteria. So that's all going to aggregate and push a lot of women out of the study. So, summary of findings, not all criteria of concern, like neurological exclusions and alcohol treatment research, they affect so few people that it's not possible that they would cause a racial inequity or a gender inequity because they just don't catch hardly anybody. In contrast, criteria about social residential, do you have a job? Are you socially stable? Do you have a place to live? Do you have an address where we can send a follow-up packet? And illegal drug use criteria, in addition to your alcohol problems, do you also have problems with, you know, heroin, cocaine, or, you know, street Oxycontin or whatever, exclude high proportions of people, period, and of those people, they tend to be women and African Americans. So those two things together mean that if you have that in alcohol treatment study, you're probably going to end up with a disproportionate white male sample. The other criteria, compliance, seems to work in the opposite direction. If you throw people out for being unmotivated, you say they can't be in the study if they don't promise up front to complete treatment, that actually works in the other direction. But it seems those people who are least compliant tend to be white males, or judged least compliant in any case. Just say some other findings. Here's another paper I did with Connie Weisner with some data she gave me from Kaiser and some other programs in Contra Costa County, which is near there. We've done this sort of simulation elsewhere, and we saw in both public and private systems, almost all exclusions in some ways were more likely to fall on African-American people and low-income people, as well as people who had more severe comorbidities. So the more ill you were, the more likely you would be excluded from an alcohol treatment study. All right. So since that, you know, those studies, we've also kind of poked around in other disorders. So I was very happy. The Norwegian government actually contacted me when they read these papers, and they said they thought this was a very important issue for Norway, which I think shows how wonderful Norway is. They were concerned about African Americans, and they're concerned about poor people, even though they have neither, but they have a strong commitment to social justice. And so they supported this study led by Hans Melberg, a Norwegian researcher, and we together briefed their, sort of like the equivalent of their Institute of Medicine, about this issue and how it might affect the provision of healthcare in Norway. And one of the things Hans and I did was just look through trials. This is now for people, drug-dependent patients. And this is the picture of what happens in clinical trials in the drug field. And you can see the blue is how many people proportion actually get in, which is less than half. And then, you know, more than a third are excluded, and then another 20% are unwilling. So this again suggests that the literature of the field is different than what the people who treat patients in the field experience day to day, because they don't exclude whatever that is, 57% of their patients. I've been looking at this in other disorders. This is one of my favorite studies of it in depression by Haberfellner, who took the criteria from an ongoing double-blind RCT, which had 28 different eligibility criteria, and applied them to 216 consecutive real-world depression patients seen in outpatient care. 215 of the 216 were ineligible, and sadly enough, the last eligible patient refused to participate. And so the point of this paper was that this looking at real-world depression practice, literally no one out of 216 patients would have ended up in a study that is supposedly to inform the care of depression. Max Halverson and I have done some more extensive work on this and kind of reviewing the field. And in depression studies, the typical study, about 80% of patients with depression could not get in. This is true, by the way, for other disorders. We have a group we call the Cross-Disease Review of Exclusion Across Medicine, or the CREAM group. we've just been pulling literature together, but you can see the exclusion rates for other disorders, different types of cancers, CVD, panic disorder, schizophrenia, Alzheimer's disease. They're all very, very high. So we started out studying this in alcohol treatment, but this is clearly not something that is unique to alcohol treatment. It actually seems to be very common in medical research that most patients with a disorder cannot get into the studies that are supposed to guide their care. So what do we learn from the second study here? So a lot of patients, of real-world alcohol patients, are ineligible under the most commonly used eligibility criteria in the field. The ones who are excluded tend to be from socially marginal groups. They tend to be, as I mentioned, poor people, tend to be African Americans, women, and some of the criteria tend to exclude more too. Now, when I presented this work before, some people say, that's no problem. All you have to do is oversample those excluded groups. And just want to make clear that that is not correct. That would not solve the problem. And just to explain why, if you were doing a study and you said you had to be, a subject had to be 5'10" tall to be enrolled, you would obviously enroll more males than females because males are taller than females. And if you said, that's okay, we'll just keep recruiting women who are over 5'10" until we get to 50-50% male-female, problem solved. But of course the problem isn't solved because the women you've enrolled in your study are less representative of all women than the men are that you've enrolled in your study. So all that all over sampling done is it makes an unrepresentative group larger. Or another way to think about it is it gives you a more precise estimate of the wrong answer. So this is not something you can fix by oversampling. Okay, the last study, the other question one wonders about is, do you change the outcomes? You know, is what we see in our research and we think this treatment works or doesn't work or how well it works actually what happens in real life? And this paper is also done with Alex Fox-Harris and Ken Weingart. You can see the publication there. So we're using the same type of analysis we used in the second study, where we're taking the ASI and we operationalize criteria and we've applied them to real-world samples, but we had follow-up data so we can see how did the excluded people do versus how did the included people do. And just as a reminder, the amount of difference between those two variables is a function of two things, which is what proportion of people are excluded? If it's only 1 or 2, 3, 4, 5%, it's not going to matter, or if it's 30, 40, 50%. And then second, how different are the outcomes between the two groups? So to show how we do this in Washington State, again, we did it with all the samples, but here's just one of them. Patients were followed up at 6 months. We had the addiction severity index that has an alcohol composite index, which is sort of an omnibus statement of the person's alcohol problems. And we used how much they improved as the outcome of the study. And the average person improved 0.28 on a 0 to 1 scale. And so then we started applying different exclusions and seeing how did the outcomes of the study change. And so if you applied a psychiatric exclusion, the outcomes got 8 to 7% worse. Medical exclusions tend to about 10% worse. Drug use, they got better. Compliance, they got better. And social residential exclusions, they got better. Some of these are non-intuitive. That's again, you know, part of the message we say is that people often exclude from studies confident in the idea that they're increasing the homogeneity of treatment response. But it's very hard to guess when you start excluding people because everything is connected to everything, what the outcomes will be. But these are, again, single criteria, and you can see can actually change the results of a study a fair amount. So what does that mean practically? If your treatment truly worked 50% of the time, if you kind of knew that, you know, from a position of omniscience, you could make that treatment look like it worked 60% of the time by excluding noncompliant and homeless patients. Or you could make it look like a treatment that worked only 40% of the time if you didn't exclude patients with medical and psychiatric comorbidities. And these are, you know, things I think most people would do by accident. There's always a possibility, of course, for people doing this on purpose, or sort of on purpose. If you're maybe somebody's selling a treatment and they have a financial interest in the treatment, or maybe they're famously known for this treatment and they have a reputational interest in it, that they could change the results of how well it works, or how well it appears to work, just by altering the exclusion criteria. So that's just some concern when, again, in treatment, you take what you get for the most part. You don't have the option to do that. So what does all that mean? Well, research studies can be designed to generate substantially different outcomes than does everyday practice. And that means some of the, I think the tendency in the field is to say when clinicians don't apply science to sort of flog clinicians for being foolish or whatever, but I think another plausible explanation is it's a lack of credibility that's born of the fact that the research samples really are different and the outcomes in those studies really are different than what clinicians experience in the front line when they work with real patients. This also means that integrations of studies across literature must consider eligibility criteria, and this is rarely done. If you look at meta-analyses, they look at effect sizes, but they often do not look at who was excluded from these various studies, and effect sizes are going to vary based on that. Whether you've got a nicely creamed sample or whether you have a sample with lots of people with lots of difficulties in it. Another important point about exclusion criteria, there's a paper by Van Spaal in JAMA reviewing influential medical journals, things like JAMA and New England Journal and stuff like that, and just looked at when people excluded subjects, did they explain why? And less than half the time did they really give any justification. And I think that it reflects something I saw when I was on NIH review panel, is that a lot of scientists seem to think that exclusion criteria go without saying. Good science has exclusion criteria. And you don't have to justify them. Whereas you have to justify everything else. You have to justify your statistical approach. You have to justify your question. But it's very rare when you see we're excluding all these people, someone says why. And something I, over and over again, just take one example, when I was NIH, I would see, you know, everybody over the age of 62 was excluded. And I would write back as a reviewer, so if somebody was 62 years old in one day, why could they not enroll? And I wasn't being argumentative. I just wanted to know. And in no case did the author ever come back and give a reason. Very often they said it was, I don't know, it was in the last grant, so I just kind of copied and pasted it forward. That's not a good reason to have an make any methodological decision. There should be some rationale. So implications across all these studies. We should tailor these eligibility criteria. I think we use them too much, honestly, in general, but we also at least need to report them. We have, at least in, you know, the field I work the most, a quarter of studies don't even reveal what they are, and those that do reveal them often describe them in such vague ways it's almost impossible to figure what people were talking about. We also need to shift viewing these criteria like we would any other methodological decision, meaning you have to have a reason for them. There are costs and benefits. I think a lot of people sort of implicitly think they only have benefits. They can have benefits. You take people out who are might be harmed, maybe people you're trying to find a homogeneous effect, an efficacy study, and so on. There's no denying there's some benefits, but there's also costs, meaning you have to have a rationale because you are losing something when you use them. And to shift the standard proof is that they're not good, they're not bad, but just like anything else in the study, you have to say why. You have to weigh those choices. Within my field of alcohol research, I think drug use exclusions may not be justifiable anymore. The reality is that, you know, something like 20% of people seeking treatment these days are just alcohol patients. So that you've already made the research nearly irrelevant when you exclude people who use other drugs. And then when you add further that you're going to cut out disproportionately women and people of color, that to me makes it very, very hard. I'm very, very skeptical of the value in alcohol research of not letting people who have problems with other drugs in. I think that's more about sociology and the way funding is set up. I don't think it makes scientific sense. I don't think it's socially just. And then generally, we should have a high bar for any criteria that excludes marginalized group or dramatically changes study conclusions. These are the two big costs that a lot of folks don't, I think, need to think about more when they apply these things. And you see studies that have 5, 10, 15, 20 exclusion criteria, and you really wonder why they didn't weigh the potential downsides of that in terms of maybe distorting the outcomes of the treatment or cutting out, all but the most socially stable patients, overrepresenting males, overrepresenting, people of white race. So, when those issues are live, I think we need to raise the bar, really have a really good rationale for that kind of stuff. So these are some of the wonderful people who contribute to that, and I also want to acknowledge the VA and NIAAA who have supported this research over a number of years. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the excellent presentation, Dr. Humphreys. I know that a lot of our attendees joined us after the top of the hour, so I just want to remind you to submit your questions and comments now. Please use the question section of the GoToWebinar control panel on the right-hand side of your screen. You can open that just by clicking the plus sign next to the word questions and type your question or comment into there. And we do have some great pending questions now, so we'll jump right into it. How are reporting guidelines like CONSORT and STROBE changing some of these findings? It seems that you should know more about who is being excluded now as opposed to in the past as these guidelines are more adopted.
Yeah, there is some good news on that front. So we have a paper out in JAMA Internal Medicine last year, and that was the most upbeat finding, which is from over the last 10 years or so, at least among the highly cited trials across 20 different disorders, studies are more likely to reveal what their exclusion criteria are. So that is good, and we need more of that. And I think actually CONSORT, the initial one, whatever it was actually revised a few years later to put some more attention specifically on eligibility criteria. And for example, not just telling what the criteria were, but how many people were excluded. And you see that more. So that is a good thing.
Thank you for that reply. The next question, do you think the effects of restrictions on clinical trial samples helps to explain the decline effect?
Ah, boy, that's a good one. I've never thought about it before. That's a really intriguing hypothesis. It's possible. I don't know. I've never thought about it before. It deserves more thought than I can give it off the top of my head. It's a worthy hypothesis to test. And you could imagine how that might work. As research gets more and more restrictive, we start getting floor effects because people aren't that bad off to begin with, and that would then make effect sizes smaller. So I'd love to see that tested. That's a really great, really creative idea. Thank you.
Thank you. We do have several people writing in to thank you for this informative and well-presented presentation. So to those writing in to say that, please reflect that in the feedback survey we will have at the end of the presentation. While we wait for any more questions or comments to be submitted, do you have any concluding comments or anything further you want to add while we give people a second to write in?
I don't have anything further other than to say again, if anyone has any difficulty locating the papers referenced and wants to see them, then I'm in Outlook and I'd be happy to send copies of them.
Wonderful. Well, we do really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to lend your expertise to the field. And, of course, we appreciate our attendees joining us today. And in your slide deck, you will see the contact information for Dr. Humphreys, and he is in the Outlook, as he mentioned. And somebody is writing in asking if the audio and video will be available for this session. Yes, we record all of our presentations, and all of them are posted in our online archive catalog. You will receive a follow-up email 2 days from now with a link leading directly to this particular recording, and feel free to pass it along to any colleagues you feel may be interested in this topic or anyone you know couldn't attend the live presentation. And we also have somebody that commented, this ties in well with Michael Marmot's Health Gap book. So thank you once again to all of our attendees and to you, Dr. Humphreys, and, of course, to Ruth Clapp and the Women's Health Group for helping schedule this cyber seminar and the series. I am going to close out the session now, and please wait while the feedback survey populates on your screen. It's just a few questions, but we do look very closely at your responses, and it helps us to improve sessions we've already provided, as well as topics for new sessions to help facilitate. So thank you once again. Have a good day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Keith.